Welcome to episode 36 of the Fire Safety Matters podcast, where we bring you the latest news, views and opinion from across the UK's dedicated fire industry. My name's Brian Sims and I'm the editor of Fire Safety Matters magazine. We're delighted that this podcast is sponsored by the Fire Safety event, which runs at the NEC in Birmingham from the 30th of April until the 2nd of May 2024. Fire Safety Matters is once again serving as the lead media partner for the exhibition. To register for the show, visit www.firesafetyevent.com. As always, I'm joined on the Fire Safety Matters podcast by my colleague Mark Sennett, the CEO at Western Business Media and also the founder of Fire Safety Matters magazine. Hi Mark, how's things with you?
All good here, Brian. Lovely to be back on the podcast, doing this again. How are things with you?
Really good, thanks Mark. Yes, working on the March print edition of the magazine at the moment. We're covering fire alarms and fire detection, emergency lighting and the manufacturing sector. And also, of course, including the 30-page plus preview for the Fire Safety event. We're lead media partner again for that show this year.
My word, is it 30 pages this year now? That's probably because the show keeps going and going there, doesn't it? It's just unrecognisable, that event now, of how large it's grown. So, Brian, as everybody here, we always introduce the news first. But before we do that, my normal bit here is to say you don't need to wait for this podcast to get all the latest news, prosecutions and products and services in the fire safety sector. You can go to our website. If you can't remember the web domain address, you can just throw in Fire Safety Matters in the search engine that we come. But actually, the web address is fsmatters.com. So in addition to all the news, prosecutions, products and services that you update daily, you can sign up to our weekly newsletter along with 50,000 other professionals. You can see all of our upcoming webinars. And they're all, give you a CPD certificate with your name on them if you go to them. You can watch all of our back archive of CPD webinars for free on there as well. And you can obviously see the latest digital editions of the magazine or sign up to get copies of the magazine. We'd love you to get that. And of course, you can see the labour of love that it was for you, the annual FIA guide, which is brilliant. And I know it takes a lot of time and dedication to do an annual guide, Brian, and that came out just before Christmas. So you can see that digitally on there as well. But of course, you can follow us on X or LinkedIn. Just look for Fire Safety Matters and there we are. If you want feedback on this podcast to give us that, please use hashtag FSM podcast. We'd be grateful to hear from you and all of your feedback. But Brian, this podcast always starts off all about news. And this time we're quite focused on a competency and compliance theme in the news stories that we've got there, because it's been some quite meaty stories you've covered in recent weeks. So if you don't mind, I'm going to start off with one that caught my eye. And for those of you that want to find it on the website, go into our website, fsmatters.com, and throw into the search box, "Every building should be treated as high risk, asserts BESA. That's the story we're going to cover right now. So in this story, it says many contractors are still ignoring safety regulations despite repeated warnings. The measures introduced by the Building Safety Act 2022 are already in place and affect every project. That's according to the Building Engineering Services Association, which is BESA for short. So BESA is concerned that firms do not realise the Building Safety Act has already altered the regulations that apply to all the construction work and not just higher risk, high rise residential buildings, which is HRBs for short, and therefore could face potential prosecution. While the Building Safety Act itself is primarily focused on HRBs, it has already changed many elements of the existing fire safety and building regulation landscapes, including the supporting approved documents that apply to all projects. Furthermore, there's going to be the introduction of a secondary legislation that affects all building work. So there's a comment in here that I want to read as well, and it comes from Nick Mead, who is the chair of BESA's Building Safety Act Advisory Group. And Nick says, "Anyone sitting back and waiting to see what happens is going to be in a lot of trouble. The regulator is looking for proof that involved parties are complying with regulations now and that the individuals and teams working on a project are competent to carry out the specific tasks assigned to them." So Mead asserted that the industry should be braced for a high-profile prosecution of the Building Safety Act, as the regulator will be keen to make a point. So there is much more to this story. I know, Brian, you're going to come in with another interesting quote on it, but I am kind of bracing myself for that too, Brian, that it's only a matter of time, in my opinion, before the regulator is going to want to make a statement and there will be a high-profile prosecution. Of course, that sounds particularly negative because no one wants to hear of prosecutions. It means there's failings. But we live in a real world here, Brian. Not everyone is compliant, even though they legally should be. And I think it is just a matter of time until prosecution happens. But of course, anyone that follows us covering prosecutions know this isn't a quick thing. Once you find an error and a non-compliance, so to speak, it takes time to properly investigate it, bring it through the court's process. So I'm not saying there's going to be one next week. And this is still relatively new legislation, Brian, isn't it? But it's coming. And I think this story that you've covered is really interesting because people need to take this seriously. I think you've got something else you wanted to add to this, Brian.
I do indeed, Mark. Rachel Davidson, BEES's Director of Specialist Knowledge, believes it's hardly surprising that there's a degree of confusion as the industry tries to adapt to the new regulations. Davidson has stated, Mark, we are trying to move away from the previously accepted approach of build and design, where it was all about rushing into projects and then trying to sort out the details later. We do know what needs to be done, but many contractors are sitting back and waiting to see what happens. That's the riskiest approach to take. In conclusion, Davidson's noted, companies are only being asked to do what they should already have been doing before the Building Safety Act was brought forward, which is comply with existing regulations. What are people actually waiting for? I think that's a completely fair point to make, in fact, Mark.
Absolutely. It is indeed. And we're going to carry on this theme now, Brian, because I know that you picked out an interesting news story. What have you got for us as your first story?
Yes, as part of its ongoing dialogue with government departments and the Health and Safety Executive, Local Authority Building Control has sent a detailed letter to the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, also the Building Safety Regulator and the Welsh Government, repeating its concerns in relation to building control capacity, given the 6th of April deadline for the registration of the building control profession, Mark. The letter, which is signed by Local Authority Building Control CEO Lorna Stimpson, concentrates on the aforementioned deadline and its implications for local authorities going forward, while also proposing suggestions as to how a government could mitigate some of the key issues outlined. LABC has explained, "We feel it's important to consider all of the options available at this stage to ensure that, come the 6th of April this year, the pipeline of construction, compliance and enforcement is not negatively impacted." As things stand, Mark, Local Authority Building Control asserts that, and I quote, "a significant number of building control professionals will not achieve successful certification, and that being so, registration, ahead of the stated deadline. At present, LABC is, and again I quote, actively encouraging all building control surveyors to submit their applications as soon as possible. In parallel, the organisation, which represents all local authority building control teams in England and Wales, is undertaking urgent review of the position of all local authorities in order to determine their stance with regards to the number of surveyors likely to be certified and registered prior to the deadline. According to LABC, and again I quote, the current picture does not look encouraging. Lorna Stimpson and the team at Local Authority Building Control have requested that the deadline should be extended, Mark, by 6 months or more. Local Authority Building Control has asserted, legal advice is clear. Those who have not achieved registration by legislative deadline are not able to meet the contractual obligations of their role and, as such, could have their employment terminated by their employer. This is the same for practitioners in both the public and private sectors, and yet another pressure added to already struggling surveyors. What are your observations on this one, Mark?
Well, before I go into that, obviously this is a really detailed story and, you know, we're just scratching the surface on it, Brian. So if you want to read it in full, go to fsmatters.com or just search engine Fire Safety Matters. And in the search box on our site, throw in the search term LABC expresses repeat concerns and up comes this story. But let's talk about positive note for a minute. LABC has stated that there are many experienced and technically skilled workers from across England and Wales who've already had their competence validated by the Building Safety Competence Foundation, which is BSCF for short, easy for me to say, and other routes. And, you know, many more will be joining them before the government's proposed deadline. So that's the positive, right? But I do think that it's potentially inevitable that deadline will be extended, but you can't actually just presume that. People need to be compliant and signed up before that. So there are also over 500 surveyors being assessed by BSCF in the coming 3 weeks. And in fact, all of whom will receive their results before the 6th of April deadline. So just want to comment one thing. LABC add another quote into this article, which is interesting. We're aware that the other two independent assessment schemes are working equally hard to ensure that those surveyors who have applied are assessed in time. Developers, architects and clients concerned about the availability of building control services should be reassured that the BSCF is doing everything it can to ensure that as many surveyors as possible have had their competency validated by the deadline, such that oversight of projects remains unaffected. For its part, Brian, LABC says it will continue to work positively with all parties in the managed transition to the new building control regime, providing updates to LABC members and indeed to all stakeholders over the coming weeks. So, Brian, it's at this point we move on to our returning guest in the podcast, and that's Warren Spencer. And I sat down with Warren earlier today, and here's what he had to say. Morning, Warren. Great to see you back on the podcast. How are you?
I'm good, Mark. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Thank you very much for taking me to the Blackpool versus Oxford game. A 1-1 draw. Not the result that we both wanted, but a good day out for the FSM team anyway. Thank you, my friend.
Oh, you're welcome. It was good to see you.
So, off of football, which I know is obviously my favourite topic, we have a little bit more important stuff to talk about today. It's been a while since we've done a podcast, and we're back on track now. And just before Christmas, you know, you were busy as always, and you did an article for us, and Brian published it on the website. So those of you who want to go on to fsmatters.com, you throw into the search engine, prosecution case launched against fire risk assessor collapses. That's what it's titled. Warren, you were heavily involved in this. It's not often we get to talk about a case collapsing like this, and it's a very interesting case. So do you want to share with us a bit more about what happened?
Yeah, this is a case where I was on the other side, so I was for the defendant, and the defendant was a risk assessor, and he also had a company, both of whom were charged in relation to a risk assessment completed in January 2020, just before lockdown. You'll remember that we locked down in March 2020. It was a nursing home premises, and he did a risk assessment. He'd used digital software. I think it was one of the first times he'd used it, and he did his risk assessment, and in the November, there was a fire at the nursing home, and the fire service came in, and they were concerned that the smoke had spread very quickly, and asked to look at the fire risk assessment. They were handed a document by the responsible person, which was purported to be the risk assessment that had been completed by my client, and they formed the view that that was not suitable and sufficient for a number of reasons. Primarily, their concern was that it hadn't identified breaches in compartmentation in the premises. They then sent it to an expert who expressed concern on two points, which was the time allowed for remedial works to be done on the premises, which showed that it had been done in January 20 and that the remedial works should be done by December 20, and that was criticised as being too long. And another point was that there had been no consideration for evacuation of the use of walkie-talkies because there was limited staff, for example, on a night shift. And so all in all, and on a fine balance, the expert for the prosecution said that it was not suitable and sufficient and probably just about put people at risk of death or serious injury. And it was a very difficult case to defend because my client could not understand why the dates were in the risk assessment, because he said they were auto-filled, and therefore, if he said it needed 30 days for certain remediation works to continue to be carried out, then 30 days would be inputted into the document. And he did have one of those scales of if it was red, it needed to be done by this date. If it was orange, it needed to be done within this date, etc. And that scale showed that these things should have been done within 30 days, and he couldn't work out why the fire risk assessment said in December, because he just had no explanation for it. In the end, because they got an expert, we got an expert, and the expert went to visit the premises. There were a couple of concerns about the premises because the plans that had been used in this prosecution for the premises were from 1996, and both my client and everybody else thought that they did not reflect the premises as they were found in 2020. And then when the expert went to the premises, he asked for the fire risk assessment. And the responsible person gave him a document, which was the paper copy. And that paper copy had the right dates in it. And it just so happened my client had done his own inquiries with the software company. And he was told that when anybody goes in to look at or use the fire risk assessment or to put in anything that's been done recently to update it, whatever, it then auto-filled those data fields with the next 30-day date. So when it read in December, it was superimposing what previously said February. So on that basis, his fire risk assessment, his original fire risk assessment, was better than it seemed. The other aspect was my client said, hold on a minute, we've been criticised for not advising use of walkie-talkies and number of staff on for evacuation. I've actually got a report here that showed that we did that the previous year. And in the narrative of the report, it said you need to sort out your walkie-talkies and you need to look at the staff issues. So we'd done that in 2019. And of course, this hadn't been provided to the fire service. So at that point where we realised that the prosecution was in fact based upon an incorrect document. It was something that they said was not suitable and sufficient, but it wasn't the document that my client had produced. So on that case, at that point, obviously I make certain submissions and go in full steam to say, what's going on here? This is outrageous. We've had a 2-year prosecution based upon an incorrect document. And why hasn't the previous reports of my client in relation to evacuation being disclosed, because they're clearly relevant and should be read in conjunction with the fire risk assessment? At that point, the case was dropped. And so that's a very brief summary of the case. I'm going to go into a bit more detail in an article a bit later on. But the concern there, my usual concern for fire risk assessors, first of all, being judged on something that fire officers find 10 months later in premises, when 10 premises could have significantly altered. In this case, they had significantly altered. A lift shaft had been put in and wiring had been taken place, rewiring had taken place throughout the COVID period. So, in fact, compartmentation had been compromised between January and November. That was accepted in the prosecution. The other point is that the responsible person was not prosecuted. They literally took the blame provided by the responsible person to the risk assessor and went with that, rather than thinking, hold on a minute, the fire safety order actually says that the responsible person is ultimately responsible for these premises, and if there are compartmentation issues, they're the responsible person just as much as the risk assessor, and of course the risk assessor can't control the compartmentation, but the responsible person can. So the decision not to prosecute that responsible person was a very strange one. And then effectively basing a prosecution on information provided by that responsible person and the fact that full disclosure was not made, very concerning. So again, I do think this is leaving fire risk assessors exposed, and I've been banging on, as you know, Mark, because I've done it in webinars and podcasts, is what is being done to protect fire risk assessors by their membership bodies? You know, I advocated a group of sort of fire risk assessment body. I have also said I don't think we need another body to go with all the ones that we've got, the 25 or so that we've got. But it still outlines that he had no help. It cost him a lot of money to defend that case, and ultimately, of course, it goes back to the prosecution expert, who says, you know what, now that we know what we know, there's nothing wrong with this, there's a few minor issues, but they haven't placed anybody at risk of death or serious injury. So a case that innocent man taken through the courts for a 2-3 year process, cost him a lot of money. And ultimately, a good result, but you can understand. At first, it's a good result, and then you sit back and think, this was all wrong from the start.
Yeah, a lot of money spent, a lot of time, a lot of stress for your client. And it's not often we talk about a case where, you know, you are defending someone, because we talk a lot about, we do mock trials together, don't we, Warren? And we're going to do one later in the year together in the new FSM Live Manchester conference on the 3rd of October. So we'll be putting all details up about that in June, July, everybody. So don't get too excited now. We'll have details up closer to the time. But something to get excited about is we do 3 or 4 webinars, Warren and I, together a year for all of you. And we tend to put them on a Friday because people quite like them on a Friday, because it's something to get a head around towards the end of the week. And we've actually got the next one planned, haven't we, Warren, on the 10th of May at 10 a.m. And don't worry, you can go onto social media by the time you're listening to this and see the links to register up for it. But Warren, you know, I've told when it is. It's online, 10th of May, 10 a.m. What are we going to cover? Give a little sneak peek.
Mark, this is a subject that I've tried to avoid for a very long time, and I succeeded until about 2015-16, when someone asked me to do a short speech, they said, on fire safety law relating to supported living accommodation, which is complex because it's very often owned by a local authority, it's leased to a housing association, it's then leased to a service provider, and then there may be carers involved, and all of whom may have some responsibility under the fire safety order. So a very tricky subject, and there is guidance on the supported living situation from a fire safety point of view, Colin Todd's report, a very detailed report, and there is a little bit on enforcement on it, but what I want to try to do is take that enforcement aspect a little bit further to provide, if I can, a little bit of clarification as to who will be responsible and where under the fire safety order for certain things, and where it's not clear, what will happen if it's not clear.
Yeah, that's all on the 10th of May at 10 a.m. You can follow on social media. It should be up at our website by now, fsmatters.com. Yeah, do come along to that special 2-hour webinar that we do together. They're really interesting sessions because actually we do it so it's really interactive. So all the delegates can ask as many questions as they can as well. We take multiple breaks of questions throughout the presentations to get questions to Warren. Warren never shirks those questions, and obviously he gets a copy of the questions at the end. So if there's something he hasn't covered that isn't rhetorical, he can always get here his team to get back to you. So yeah, have a look at our website for that. 10th of May, 10 a.m. Special webinar with Blackhurst Bud. But before then, Warren, as we always end the same way, if people want to get any legal advice, find out more about you and your business, Blackhurst Bud, what's the best way to do so?
So it's Blackhurst Bud website, Fire Safety Law website. I'm on LinkedIn and was Twitter, now X. I'm there. If you want to find me, you can Google me.
If nothing else, you can tell we're current again because you said X, not Twitter. So you know this wasn't recorded a year ago. Warren, great to see you as always. And we'll see you in the next episode. Thanks, Warren.
Returning to the news now, and the Regulator of Social Housing has just published the findings arising from its second survey on the fire safety of buildings in the social housing sector, standing 11 metres or higher above ground level. The report duly highlights the responsibility of boards and councillors alike to understand landlords' legal obligations in relation to managing the safety of such buildings and, by extension, their occupants. All social landlords are required to submit quarterly data to the Regulator of Social Housing and the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities concerning the fire safety remediation of relevant buildings for which they are ultimately responsible. In addition, landlords were asked to submit fire safety remediation data at an individual building level for detailed assessment by the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities. The survey opened, Mark, on the 1st of December last year and closed at the end of that same month, with data reported as of 30th of November. Around 30% of all landlords for whom the Regulator of Social Housing holds data identified themselves as being responsible for at least one building of 11 metres tall or higher. Positively, Mark, the results show that fire risk assessments have been undertaken on circa 98% of all buildings reported, while the majority of remaining buildings will be subject to such a process across the next 9 months and more. Landlords also reported that remediation work is complete or otherwise due to be completed For the majority of buildings with external wall system-related life-critical fire safety defects by September 2028. Life-critical fire safety defects are defined as defects, shrinkages, faults or other failings in a building that give rise to fire safety risks identified by a fire risk appraisal of the external wall construction or a fire risk assessment or equivalent undertaken to accepted industry standards. Do you have anything more to add on this one, Mark?
Well, this is the point of the podcast where everyone expects me to go on a rant that say 98% isn't 100%, because I normally am that person on this podcast, and that would be fair comment, Brian, to say 98% carried out a fire risk assessment should be 100%. But actually, let's take the positives out of this. There's some interesting statistics there. 98% is nearly full-on compliance with, obviously, as you said, the remaining buildings currently going through that process in the next 9 months. And obviously, remediation work is all but completed on most of these projects. So there is some positive news here on that. So I do have a little bit more to add to it, if you will humour me for a moment. And the regulator of social housing will continue to monitor the performance of landlords in remediating 11 metre plus buildings and the progress they're making against their outlined plans. So the comment I wanted to pull out from this actually comes from Will Perry, who is the director of strategy at the regulator of social housing. And he's explained, landlords must take timely action to remediate fire defects in the buildings for which they're responsible so that the tenants are safe and, what's more, can feel safe in their homes. It's for the boards and councillors to ensure these plans are delivered. They must take action to mitigate risks to tenants. We will continue to engage with landlords through our ongoing regulation, including the new programme of inspections beginning from April this year. And I'm sure we will revisit this topic at some point following those these inspections, Brian. I'm sure we will. So if you want to have a good look at that story, again, go to the website, the normal thing here, fsmatters.com, throw into the search box at the top, second fire safety remediation report, and up this will come in its entirety. And so, Brian, we're jam-packed with guests on this episode. We've actually got three, so it's now time to go to our second guest. And who have you got for us?
Our guest on episode 36 of the Fire Safety Matters podcast is former civil servant Terry Edge, who, from 2004 until 2016, served as the lead official on the Furniture and Furnishings Fire Safety Regulations 1988 at what is now the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. Since leaving the civil service, Terry has been a freelance furniture fire safety consultant, advising the All-Party Parliamentary Fire Safety and Rescue Group, the Irish Government, the Fire Brigades Union's Contaminants Group, and also the members of several Grenfell Tower survivor groups. Terry was the joint author of a detailed report which led to an inquiry into toxic chemicals in everyday life conducted by the Environmental Audit Committee. Subsequently, it was recommended that the government should amend the Furniture and Furnishings Fire Safety Regulations accordingly. After explaining the backstory in some detail, Terry then addresses the recent consultation process put in motion by the Office for Product Safety and Standards and reported by Fire Safety Matters, and offers his thought-provoking views as to what needs to happen next in the domain of furniture fire safety.
Welcome to the podcast, Terry. What first prompted your involvement in the subject of furniture fire safety, and why did you decide to become a whistleblower?
Yeah, hello, Brian. Thanks for having me on today. I got into furniture fire safety via working for the civil service, Whitehall Government Department, Department for Business, and pretty much accidentally in Whitehall departments as a civil servant, you're really supposed to focus not so much on the job you do, but on becoming an all-round policy maker. The only catch with that is nobody seems to know what policy is. So I just bumped into the furniture regs as something, you know, a different job to try. I joined the civil service quite late, in my late 30s. I've been doing all sorts of things before that. So I joined the civil service, did various things, and actually was doing pretty well. You know, I had a couple of promotions, and I was pretty much keep my head down and doing what I was supposed to do. And similarly, the furniture regs, you know, I applied and got in. So I was leading the lead official on the furniture regs and the nightwear safety regs, which are also UK only fire safety regulations. And I, at the time, for a long time, really, everybody, including myself, believed that the furniture regs were a very good thing overall, you know, that they worked, that they saved lives. So they were long overdue for a review, because they came out in 88, 89, and government policy is to review regulations every 5 years, but they hadn't been reviewed at all. The government initiated a kind of review in 2004, and industry were rather annoyed with them, because industry came up with 21 points that needed amending and reviewing in the regulation, all of which were pretty reasonable. But I don't know why, but the minister at the time seemed to get cold feet, and she didn't really want to go ahead. So they fobbed off industry a bit. And so we rolled on, and it got to about 2009. My boss moved on and he wasn't replaced. So I was in effect leading on the regs at that time. So I felt we needed to do a review, wrote to the minister at that time, and put a case together for reviewing the regs. And bear in mind, at this time, we still thought that they were successful, because deregulation was the big thing, and still is really. We had to show that a review would save money. So we did that by trading standards and the fire services giving us some figures on basically the money they would save if the regulations were made clearer, because everybody agreed, although they worked, they weren't very, there were lots of grey areas and things that hadn't been decided and so forth. So trading standards spend a lot of their time going around having to explain things to businesses, and the fire services similar. And I think they came up together with something like it would save about 36 million a year. And on that basis, the minister, it was Ed Davey at the time, gave approval for the review to go ahead. So the first thing we had to do was see if the regulations were still working. So we commissioned, went out to tender, several companies put in proposals for analysis of the fire safety data to see if the regs were working. There's a company called Green Street Berman Limited did it, so you can find the report. It's not easy, but you can find it online. And they concluded that the regulations were saving about 54 lives a year. And they broke it down into the three main tests, the two ignition tests, which are match open flame test, cigarette test, and the fillings test. Now, if we get time, I'll explain why that was not really a valid thing to do. Basis for claiming that the furniture regs saved lives was the first statistical report done in the year 2000 by Surrey University Professor Gary Stevens. But basically, he just guessed. And the reason being, there are no stats for lives saved from fires. There are only stats for the reduction in fire deaths, furniture fire deaths. And from that, Gary Stevens said, well, there's three main reasons for reductions in death, or he said lives saved. He said increase in smoke alarms and a decrease in home smoking and the furniture regulations. But he just guessed that the furniture regs were saving about 70 lives from fires. So we launched the review 2009-2010, and it's a very productive review. Everybody was happy to get involved, wide range of stakeholders, industry, trading standards, all sorts of people. We had lots of regular meetings, all of which were very open. Nothing was in the way, everything was recorded, all notes were sent out, et cetera, et cetera, which I led on for quite a few years. We had a bit of a hitch when the government decided to launch something called the Red Tape Initiative, which was they wanted to get rid of any regulations which they saw as a barrier to trade, really. And then it got to about 2012. And at that time, I've just started to become aware that flame-retardant chemicals might be a problem. Most furniture in the UK still uses flame-retardant chemicals to meet the requirements of the three tests. Manufacturers don't have to, but basically they're the cheapest way to meet the tests. And a turning point for me was I went to a meeting in the European Parliament where a UK MEP was proposing to the EC that the rest of Europe should have the same level of regulations for furniture that we do, because actually it doesn't. It basically doesn't really have anything much. And there I stood up and I said, you know, these are the most successful regulations in the world. They're saving 54 lives a year. And as far as we can tell, there's not a problem with flame time chemicals. And then after that meeting, two women approached me. One was from IKEA, and the other was from the Green Science Policy Institute in America. And they said, look, there's lots of problems with flame type chemicals. And I said, well, send me the details, which was not a very civil servants-like thing to say or do. And they did, and I read it, and I thought, okay, so it looks like there are problems. So from that point, this was about early 2013, I decided to see if we could, in this review, find a way to reduce flame chance without reducing fire safety. So I worked with the leading test expert in the country, a guy called Steve Owen, who's, I think, quite brilliant. And we decided that we could change the main match open flame test in such a way that would actually improve fire safety, but would reduce flame retardants in cover fabrics by about 50%. Steve did an initial very technical paper, which we circulated to about 20, 40 people in the industry that should understand it and be able to comment on it. And we got all their comments back. And then we produced a more general paper, which went out to about 200 stakeholders. I'm saying all of this, by the way, because I want to show how well consulted people were on the changes we proposed in 2014, which is a stark comparison with what's going on today, by the way. So from that, Steve and I produced, with approval from our managers and everybody else, we produced a consultation document, which went out in 2014. And it went out early because, bearing in mind, we were reviewing the entire regulations at this point. And our intention was that this new proposed open flame match test would come out with the rest of the regulations. But ministers at the time were getting a bit desperate to announce successes on deregulation. And that was the first time I thought about these regulations maybe saving money. So I put up a paper and said, well, look, these regulations should save industry about 50 million a year. And ministers got very excited about that. And there was pressure on me to bring forward this new match open flame test, bring forward from the overall review. And then we did that. Industry wasn't too happy about it, but we said, well, you're going to save money earlier. And that's what happened. It came out in 2014 and we got 113 responses, which was quite a lot for what was really just a proposal for changing apparently successful regulations. But what happened was that we hadn't fully twigged how important this was, but in the consultation document and a technical annex, which Steve wrote and I edited, which is still on the Department of Business website, which conclusively proves that the regulations don't actually work. They're not fully effective. The open flame test fails in about 90% of cases in real life, for example. So that was a bit of a bombshell, but it was slightly muted because we only really realised this right at the end. So the responses, the vast majority were positive, but there were a few negative responses from the people you might imagine, the chemical industry, for example. And then without going into too much detail, I suddenly found myself on my own. The ministers had approved these proposals to go ahead the following year, in 2015. And there was no reason we shouldn't have gone ahead because, in my view, that none of the proposals constituted a problem with what we were proposing. As this was something confirmed by a ChemTrust, a green lobby group, who following year demanded that the department publish all of these consultation responses. And they went through them all. And then they wrote to the minister and said, we cannot find any serious objection to what you're proposing. So why don't you go ahead? But my managers, they wanted to do more work. And I kept arguing, well, there is no more work. So we've done it all. It's all online. It's all done. What do you want to do that's more work? The minister at the time, Jo Swinson, became very confused and irritated because she had me and Steve saying, no problem, ready to go. My manager said, oh, no, we must do more work. And in the end, she said to me, look, you write me a paper, a 4-page paper, write it on your own. And I did that. And she said it was excellent. And I thought, well, here we go. But she had some further questions, which I answered, which weren't put to her. The short end of it is that Swinson decided to delay. I should say one of the things we hadn't realised was that the furniture industry were very pleased with these regulations. There are a number of big businesses that benefit directly. So, for example, the chemical industry, the flame retardant industry, benefits considerably from them. The chemical treatment industry, they're the people that apply chemical paste to the undercover fabrics full of flame retardant chemicals, almost entirely depend on these regulations to exist. And the foam industry make an absolute fortune from producing flame retardant foam, which is almost exclusively for the UK market. Testing industry benefits, etc., etc. But what we hadn't really fully realised was that, of course, the UK furniture industry benefits because these regulations are a barrier to trade. You know, if you are a German manufacturer, say, and you want to sell furniture in the UK, you have to comply with the UK regulations. And that's very costly, especially if you're not producing in bulk like UK companies do. So I had to make a decision. I could see this was going to drag on. And I was under considerable pressure fighting my managers all the time. So I did take out a whistleblowing case. And my case was that ministers were being misled. No further work has been done since then. So I would suggest that proves that I was right alone. The whistleblowing case just dragged on and dragged on. They hadn't done anything on it for months. I retired from the department during the middle of it because I'd had enough. And the Sunday Times wanted to do an article on flame retardants, furniture, etc. So they called up the department and said, we're going to publish an article on Terry Oshie's whistleblowing case tomorrow. Have you got anything you want to say? Well, I then got my whistleblowing case final report the very next day. But it was only a one-page report. It only had one point that was relevant, which said, we can find no evidence that ministers have been misled, even though I gave them over 400 documents and 7 hours of testimonies to that end. So that's why I became a whistleblower. It was conscience, really. I just thought, well, if nobody chases this, it's in most people's interests to just let it go on and go on and go on. So that's why, even after I retired, I still continue working with people and pushing for changes to be made.
The government claims that the furniture and furnishings fire safety regulations deliver the best fire safety levels in the world, Terry, and also save lives. Do you agree with that assertion?
No, I don't. And I would say that the government itself, Department for Business, actually proved they don't provide fire safety. In those two documents I mentioned earlier, the 2014 consultation document and the 2015 technical annex. And also, I also said earlier, there's no way of knowing if lives have been saved from fires, only that deaths have been reduced. There's no evidence of that. It's not to say they haven't saved some lives, but there's no evidence of that. And also, if it was true, the UK should be by far leading in, say, Europe and America for lives saved from furniture fires, but it isn't. Some research was done a number of years back, which suggested the UK was about sixth in Europe. So there are five countries in Europe with a better record that don't have furniture regulations.
The recent consultation on the furniture regulations realised by the Office for Product Safety and Standards suggests that new regulations will be ready at some point later on this year. Isn't that a positive step forward in your view?
No, it isn't. Firstly, because it isn't true. And secondly, because what they intend by way of new regulations are pretty much exactly what we've got now. In other words, fire safety measures that don't work but produce a lot of toxic flame retardant gas when furniture burns. They are claiming, they've done this publicly, they're claiming that by October this year, new regulations will be in place. And they've also claimed that the standards to enact those regulations will be ready about that the same time, because without the standards, obviously nothing can be enacted. So even if they publish something in later this year, all they can say is, well, until we get the standards to enact these regulations, continue with the existing regulations. Now, I was on the committee at British Standards until recently that was meant to be coming up with these new standards. To date, you know, February 2024, no work has even been started at British Standards on these so-called new standards, which is, if there was time, I'd go into the reasons for it. And that's, you know, 5 years on from British Standards being commissioned to do this work. We could have standards ready by 2028. Now, I would say that's highly unlikely anyway, but even if they do, that's going to be another 4 years, you know, and that will be 14 years on from the government itself announcing any fact that these regulations are ineffective and flame retardants do nothing but poison people.
And what do you believe to be the main reason behind the long delay in putting the furniture regulations right, Terry?
Well, I think there's two main reasons. The first is money. These regulations are incredibly lucrative for a number of industries. As I said, the furniture industry itself, the flame retardant industry, the chemical treatment industry, the foam industry, the testing industry. Very, very lucrative. I mean, it's very difficult to get exact figures, but let's say you can work it out yourself. Let's say that we worked out at one stage that the average house contains about 45 kilograms of flame retardants in its furniture. And the cost of flame retardants in furniture is roughly about 50 to 60 pounds a unit, say a mattress or a sofa. 27 million homes in the UK. And the industry say that people change their furniture about every 8 years. So divide that by eight, that's, you know, 3.5 million or whatever. And times that by maybe, you know, 200 quid. It's a lot of money. That's the first thing. The second thing now, unfortunately, is the government saving face. Because the government has known, everyone's known, since 2014 that these regulations do not work. And that was confirmed by an inquiry undertaken by the Environmental Audit Committee, or Government Select Committee, 2019, did a vast amount of research, called every witness you can imagine, a fantastic amount of work, and concluded, they agree with me, that basically the UK regulations are not fit for purpose. Two of the main tests should be dropped, the open flame test, which no one else in the world uses, and the fillings test, which also no one else in the world uses. But they are proposing still to keep the open flame test. And this is because it's as simple as, you know, they're trying to save face. That's my view. It's extraordinary to think that for, you know, since 1988, we've had regulations in place that produce vast amounts of flame retardants in people's homes, which are very damaging, even in their non-active state, because they leach out furniture, they get into our blood and get into our thyroid glands and all sorts of things. You know, research has shown that, mainly Stuart Harrod's research at Birmingham University, that UK mothers' breast milk has the highest levels of flame retardants in the world, and so on. So they've kind of dug themselves in deep, in my view, and this is why they've resisted every effort to change anything in the regulations, because their worry is that if they change one thing, the whole thing will unravel, which is probably true.
And taking the macro view, Terry, what's the current state of play in the rest of the world when it comes to furniture fire safety?
Well, the rest of the world basically doesn't have anything much other than a cigarette test. A cigarette test is fine because it can be met without the use of flame retardant chemicals, and there's a logic to it. The logic being that, you know, you might drop a cigarette on your sofa, go upstairs, go to bed, and an hour later, your sofa might catch fire, and then you're trapped upstairs with toxic fumes coming up the stairs and all the rest of it. No, Europe only in practice uses a cigarette test. They do have an open flame test, but they don't use it, and they don't have the fillings test. America, which is a very good test case, you know, they used to have an open flame test, which is a bit tougher than ours, but they, under huge pressure from the flame retardant industry, they dropped California dropped its open flame test in 2013, and California was pretty much the lead for the rest of the US. And a couple of years ago, Trump signed federal legislation, so in other words, the whole of the US, to ban flame retardants from furniture. And just recently, they've had a study done in America which has shown, perhaps not surprisingly, that since California and the US dropped its open flame test, and therefore got rid of volatile chemicals in furniture. The toxic environment has greatly improved in the average American house. So that was one of the things that is quite staggering, really. A, the regulations don't work anyway, and B, no one else uses them. And if you think about it, logic suggests there's something wrong here. For example, everybody agrees that there's no point in having flammability requirements for mattresses, right? Because the flammability resistance is the equivalent of somebody dropping a match, somebody dropping a cigarette, what's called a crew of five test, which is basically 18 grams of paper scrunched up and set light to. But nobody sleeps on a bare mattress. Everybody sleeps on bedding, and bedding catches fire first, obviously. And once it catches fire, it completely overwhelms those fire resistance recommendations for mattresses, rules for mattresses. And actually, similar with sofas. If the open flame test works, the match test, then why do you need your fillings to be treated? Because they're not going to be affected. The flame's gone out. If it doesn't work, which we know it doesn't, that means the cover fabric catches fire and anything else that's on the sofa. And again, it completely overwhelms the fire safety requirements for fillings. So there's logical reasons why these regulations don't make any sense. And the rest of the world seems to acknowledge that. But, you know, our government is ignoring it, or it's saying, as it is at the moment, against all the evidence, say, against having an open flame test. In its consultation, it said, oh, well, the National Fire Chiefs Council tell us we must have an open flame test. Lots of people have said to the OPSS, well, who has said this in the NFCC, and where is their writings about it? Where are their papers? And they don't respond. So it's a little bit like, oh, well, a bloke down the pub says, so we'd better keep this open flame test, against all the evidence that it doesn't work and we don't need one.
And finally, Terry, what do you want to see happen in times ahead when it comes to furniture fire safety?
What I want to see is that the recommendations the Environmental Audit Committee made in 2019 are implemented. And those were, as said earlier, that the UK should do what the rest of the world does. In other words, drop its open flame test, drop its fillings test, and just have a cigarette test. And, you know, the government has never really answered this. Recently, the chair of the Environmental Audit Committee wrote to the minister and basically said, you know, why haven't you implemented our recommendations? Why are you still insisting we need an open flame test, etc.? And the minister replied recently, but, you know, it's very vague. He didn't really answer any questions. So the EAC is thinking about its next move, and I hope it does push on this, because the government doesn't have any answers. So, yeah, that it's that simple. Implement the recommendations of a government select committee that did an awful lot of work into these regulations. And that will mean flame retardants will disappear from UK furniture, and the toxicity of our fires will greatly reduce. Research done by Professor Anna Steckett appeared in the papers last year, and she discovered that UK firefighters are getting cancers at something like six times the normal rate, which is almost certainly down to the toxicity of UK fires. And that is greatly down to the fact that, you know, furniture is stuffed with toxic flame retardants, incredibly toxic when they burn. They produce large volumes of hydrogen and cyanide, for example. Just one deep breath in of hydrogen and cyanide can kill you. It's very finely balanced at the moment. One level, I'm pessimistic. Another, I'm quite optimistic, because I think there's a movement gathering, people that really want to look into this and expose the truth. And then hopefully the government will finally act.
So it's time for our final news story. And as I always say, you don't need to wait to get these news stories on a podcast. They're updated daily. Brian's a busy guy on the website with all the latest news, prosecutions, products and services. Go to fsmatters.com on a daily basis. Or do you know what? If you can't spare the time for that, go to the website and sign up for our weekly newsletter. And Brian sends out every Tuesday at 10:30 in the morning, sends out the biggest stories from the previous 7 days. It's a great way to keep in touch with what's going on in the sector. And over 50,000 of you do that every week. So plenty of news to cover. Actually, I want to cover a bit of news from us, Brian, and often we do that on the podcast. So quite a big news story for me related to fire is the fact that we are returning with Fire Safety Matters Live at the Coventry Building Society Arena on the 12th of June 2024. So people will remember that we did this, the inaugural Fire Safety Matters Live, and it was a huge success last June in 2023. Well, it's back. 12th of June 2024 at the Coventry Building Society Arena. Some of you will still call it the Rico Arena. It's where Coventry City play. A couple things about that. The venue hated me called the Rico because it's got a new sponsor. And also, my partner's children are Coventry season citizen ticket holders and they beat Oxford United 6-2. So we don't talk about football, Brian. We don't talk about Coventry City. It's painful to me. So, because you can imagine, that was a great New Year's present for me. That's probably why we haven't done a podcast since January, is I've still been mourning from that result. But apparently, I'm glutton for punishment and want to hold another brilliant event at the CBS Arena. So let's talk about that. It really is an industry day and we're really proud of it. You chair the main conference of it. It's completely free to attend, but we have got limited tickets. We had 504 people attend last year. You know, there is 50 exhibitors going to be present with all the latest products and services on there. You know, Apollo are the headline sponsor. We've got some massive brands that are going to have stuff on show for you. You know, it's not just Apollo. There's Aco. There's Asecos, Advance, Baldwin, Boxall, FFE, Global, HC Global. There's so many people on here, Brian, that you come and see. But, you know, education is a key part of this. This event is, it's got everything. It covers passive fire protection and, you know, Cooper's Fire are there for that along with ASFP. But it is about a day of education. You get a CPD certificate for attending, Brian, as you know. And it's networking. And it's run alongside two other conferences, which are separate registrations, but the Institute of Fire Safety Managers do their meeting, about 250 people come, and BAFE are doing a special conference themselves there. But what I'm encouraging all of you to come to, and you go to fsmlive.co.uk, so fsmlive.co.uk to register for free. There's free parking on site, free Wi-Fi, free cloakroom. Unfortunately, the train station isn't free. You will have to pay for your train fare to get there, but there is a train station on site, as is there a hotel. But I am going to feed you. There is free lunch on site. And I'm very proud of the agenda that we've pulled together. There's an opening address by the Home Office from Matthew Armour. There is a session on fire safety meets sustainability, a path to responsible systems. Managing false fire alarms is going to be a really key session. Empowering a responsible person for safer buildings. Then you've got how to comply with the latest changes to fire safety regulations and increasing safety demands on modern buildings using the latest technology. That's Ray Puttick from EMS will do that. The Building Safety Act, Fire Safety and Project Accountability by Michael Croxford. We've got the building safety cases, how fire safety consultants can support the responsible person. So plenty of stuff here about competency, the responsible person. Plenty of stuff here for installers as well. So whether you are a fire safety manager, a consultant or an installer, there's plenty for you here. There is enhancing fire safety, unveil the power of multi-sensor alarms. Then we've got open area protection, which is the best option. Then a very popular session, this will be the changing scene of fire safety legislation and the impact of the responsible persons and fire assessors being delivered by the one and only Colin Todd. I'm sure you'll all enjoy that. We've got Steve McGurk from the Fire Sector Federation doing a session on driving national integration of fire policy. That'll be a great session. And we've got everyone's friend, Dr. Bob Doherty, the Institute of Fire Safety Managers, doing a competency of fire risk assessors. So it is a full-on day, Brian. You know, it opens at 8:30 in the morning. It's on till the afternoon all the way through to 4 o'clock. So lots of reasons to come. It's completely free, but places are limited and going really fast. So www.fsmlive.co.uk. Brian, you're chairing that. We're both obviously there. I know you're looking forward to it. What are your thoughts on the day?
That's what you said there, Mark. I have to say, I congratulate you completely on a fantastic programme. The first time I saw this programme, I thought that's really top-draw stuff. And I'd like to pick out a couple of things you mentioned there. Obviously, having an address by the Home Office is great to kick off the day. Vicky Wells, the presentation by Vicky from Apollo Fire Detectors, Mark, just to let you and the readers know, the upcoming March edition of the magazine, which of course we're taking to the fire safety event, Vicky's written actually a piece on this topic, and it follows on from a webinar I ran with us just before Christmas. So I'd advise people to get along to that session. It's really going to be pretty good, I think. Obviously, you mentioned a couple of key sessions there. Towards the end of the day, the sessions by Colin. Colin's always a massive draw, Colin Todd. Fantastic professional in the sector. He's given so much to this industry over so many years now. I'm sure that'll be a tremendous draw. Steve McGurk, of course, from the Fire Sector Federation, writes a regular column for us now in the magazine. And that'll be a great session, I'm sure. Steve's really been on the podcast already, because people can look back at previous editions of the podcast to see Steve's views on things at the moment. And, of course, Dr. Bob Doherty, a tremendous draw always. Whenever you go to see Bob at a presentation session, primarily at the fire safety event, the queue is out of the door for the presentation itself. If you want to speak to him, you normally have to wait online for about 20 minutes. I'm sure that'll be busy as well, Mark.
It will indeed. Bob, always cantankerous, but, has so much knowledge to give and share. Doesn't matter what time of day you put him, he packs out a theatre because he's just so well respected. And of course, the Institute of Fire Safety Managers are a really key partner for us. We're proud of our partnership with them. So I don't want people to miss out. I mean, it's not just how many people have already registered. It's actually, I think we had 250 people register in the first 3 days already, Brian. It's crazy. But it's also who's coming. It's like a who's who of the fire safety sector coming. So there's so much networking opportunity, and it costs you nothing. It's a day that you just can't miss. So please, before I do have to close the registration page, just before there's too many, do go to fsmlive.co.uk to sign up. But Brian, that is not the only thing that happens that day. At 4 o'clock, we might be closing the conference, but I've probably already left my own event at that point and gone to a different floor in the building, because that night we have the Fire and Security Matters Awards. And I'm not ashamed to say this, the awards processes that we do are the most fulfilling part of my job. I'll be honest, I absolutely love the awards that we do. For the sole reason, it recognises what you, the listeners, do, the vital role you do in keeping people and property safe. Now, yes, the awards do is in the evening at the same venue, the Coventry Building Society Arena. We've got brilliant comedian and well-known presenter Jason Manford hosting it this year. So I'm pretty sure he's probably going to make us all go and sing-song as part of his act. So it'll be a fun evening. And yeah, listen, there's great fun there, from free casino tables to bands to inflatable photo booth to pick and mix to you name it, drinks reception, three-course meal, etc. It's a great networking night. And there was over 640 of you there last year from the fire and security sectors. That's the night. That's not why you enter. That's a knock-on effect for a great evening of networking, and the who's who of the sector is there. But the reason you enter is because you want to try and either get yourself, you can self-nominate, a member of your team, a colleague, a team you're in, your organisation, a product, a service, a project, heck, even a client you can nominate, or a partner in there. It is the perfect way to get recognition. And I passionately believe that when people do a great job, they should be nominated. And I have nominated and been lucky enough to see a number of my teams, including Brian, win major awards in our sector for it. So I'm not a hypocrite. I enter our team into awards as well. And, you know, Brian is the reigning business publication of the year for Fire Safety Matters. And I'm very proud of him for, and Leanne and the rest of the team for that. But the categories for you to enter, I'm just going to talk about the fire ones for now, because the security ones mirror it. It's the same categories of security. This is a fire safety podcast, so we'll focus on the fire safety categories. So you've got Fire Safety Manufacturer of the Year, Fire Safety Installation Company of the Year, Fire Safety Manager of the Year, Fire Safety Team of the Year, Fire Safety Project of the Year, Fire Safety Innovation of the Year, Fire Safety Campaign of the Year, Fire Industry Woman of the Year, and a couple of new categories as well. The ESG Company of the Year with a turnover of above 10 million. That's had plenty of entries so far. ESG Company of the Year for turnover of under 10 million. Because ESG is a big topic in this sector. You just talked about sustainability with the session we're doing at the conference with Apollo and the webinar we've done with them and the article. Sustainability is a key thing. And of course, there's Distributor of the Year as well. And we will be revealing, it's not one you can nominate yourself for, the Lifetime Achievement Award as well. So lots to enter. It's free to do so. You've got until the 29th of March 2024 to do this. There's no excuse not to do it. We had a record amount of entries last year. It's a perfect way to get yourself, as I said, a member of team or your business, a campaign, etc., supported, you know, recognised, I should say. And all you need to do is go to firesecurityawards.com. That is firesecurityawards.com, or throw into a search engine, Fire and Security Matters Awards. And up we come. Please enter. That is what I'm asking you, all of you. You deserve the recognition here. These are industry awards for you. It's what a magazine should do. It should honour and recognise the great job that you do keeping people and property safe. So then, I love, this is my favourite part of my job, if I'm honest. So, Brian, have you got any thoughts on the FSM Awards?
I do. First of all, Mark, I'd like to pay tribute to all the sponsors who are supporting this year's event, if I may. And obviously the headline sponsor this time around, as you mentioned, is the Bay Fire Safety Register. Many thanks indeed to Justin and Fraser and the team there for doing this for us. Our other sponsors this year include ACO, Apollo, CTEC, EMS, FFE, the Fire Safety Event, of course, and our partners at the 19 Group, Millwood Fire Safety Engineering, SafeLinks, the Security Event, CyberEyes, Texacom as well this year, which is great to have them on board, and TO Fire Safety. I'd like also to mention, Mark, that the charity this year, our nominated charity partner once again, is an excellent charity, the Firefighters Charity.
Absolutely. It's a third year we're doing the Firefighters Charity. We have raised, I think, nearly £15,000 for that charity from the previous two awards. These awards continue to grow, and there is that very nice element to the charity side too, as we do it. And it's not dig your hand in your pocket to make a donation. You can do that. We'd say how you can do that. Actually, there is a charity auction there with some fantastic prizes that you can bid on, and the bidding went quite nuts last year and raised a lot of money, which we were thrilled about. So, yes, please do enter the awards. One last plug on that, firesecurityawards.com, or throw into a search engine, Fire and Security Matters Awards. You have got until the 29th of March 2024 to enter for free at 23:59, so 11:59 p.m. that night, GMT, I would say, on that. So, Brian, who have you got for our final guest for this episode of the FSM podcast?
Our final guest on episode 36 is David Fitzpatrick, General Manager at Smey Ventilation Systems here in the UK. For the last three decades now, David has worked in senior sales and marketing roles at board level, very often focused on growth and change strategies. Through time, David has served as Sales Director at Nuaire, Business Development Director at Colt International, and also as a partner at Obvious Consult. In a pro bono capacity, David has been an elected member of the board at the Chartered Institution of Building Services Engineers since late 2019, and also served as Chair of the SIBSE Patrons for a seven-year period. His current role at Smey Ventilation Systems began last November. David is tasked with leading on project design and systems implementation for both HVAC and smoke protection solutions, driving business growth through new UK approaches to keeping evacuation routes safe thanks to pressure differential systems. During our interview, David concentrates on the changes brought forward by the Building Safety Act 2022 and also looks ahead to the Fire Safety event at the NEC in April.
Thank you very much for agreeing to appear on the FSM podcast, David. You recently joined Smey Ventilation Systems to run the UK division, of course. Can you give us some background on the company itself and also what it is that you do?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, Brian. Smey Ventilation are a manufacturer of ventilation and smoke-related products based in Poland since 1989. And my responsibility is to run the business here in the UK with a huge amount of support that I get technically and also culturally from Poland.
And why did you choose to join the business, David?
Because I have a background in smoke ventilation type products and also have founded a company called Adexa UK, who are a smoke ventilation specialist contractor. I've always been very interested in the smoke industry. And Smey have got a particular division which focuses on staircase pressurization that I think is going to be a real key part of the market moving forward for lots of various reasons I'm sure we'll get onto. And I was quite excited about bringing something a little bit different into the UK market.
And what do you believe Smey can deliver for the fire sector, which is in some way different to the offer from other companies in the market, David?
I think, as I just alluded to a little bit, they do have a division that looks after pressurisation. And there are lots of companies in the UK that also can offer that type of design concept to people. What I think we can offer is the fact when we start looking at competency, the amount of research which they have done on how a pressurization system should work, and looking at some of the challenges you get with high-rise buildings, they've managed to find some answers to those, which I think is really different and hopefully will give clients a lot of confidence that not only have we done this for a long period of time, but the research that's gone into it should give people a lot of confidence that when we put a system together, it will work within that building for them.
Of course, you operate within the smoke control industry, as you said. Has the Building Safety Act exerted an impact within your specific market sector, David?
Nice, easy question to answer, Brian. Yes and no. I do think it's certainly having an impact. And I think we're at the very start of that journey. I think it's really important that a lot of the clients now are asking questions about design, about competency, about the testing of products, which is really good and it's really healthy. And I think it's really important that as an industry as a whole, not just SMI Ventilation, but everybody is starting to talk about key elements of making sure we're using the right tested products for the right applications, and making sure that when somebody comes to anybody for a design, that it does meet what is going to be required in the Building Safety Act. And the Building Safety Act is really going to help us do that, and it's going to create some challenges for us. And there's still lots of grey areas with it, but it will evolve, and the Act will evolve, the clients will evolve, and I also think the smoke industry will evolve as well over the next 5-10 years.
In your opinion, do the clients, from developers to contractors and on again to designers, fully understand the day-to-day impact of that legislation, do you feel?
I don't think so yet. I think it's all relatively new. We're talking about lots of things about having different stages of design before planning. I think we're talking a lot about REBA stages. We're talking about responsibilities of main contractors, main designers. But I think the one area where we haven't quite got it right yet as an industry is actually what goes on day to day, actually on site. And I think one of the things that's going to happen a lot in the next 2-3 years is where project managers used to say, yes, we've done that, that's fine, I've done that for the last 5-10 years, we're not going to be able to do that anymore. I think whereas design would be very different to actually what happens on site, part of the Building Safety Act now is saying, actually, you've got to install it exactly how you've designed it. And that's going to create huge challenges, because when a building goes up, you're looking at so many different variations to what happened when you designed it. But when it comes to smoke control, it's going to be absolutely key that holes are cut in the right place. They're the right size. Shafts are made the right dimensions. You don't get steelwork running through areas, or other wiring is put into places where the smoke control wiring should go. And I think we're now going to have to be a lot stricter and really understand that because it was okay 2-3 years ago, you're not going to be able to do the same nowadays.
And how can SMI Ventilation Systems assist in putting the key messages across?
I think there's two parts to this for us. The first one is, particularly when we want to focus on pressurization systems in high-rise buildings, we need to go out to the marketplace and really educate people about what the options are, what the challenges of pressurization have been in the past, and how they can be properly overcome. And I think we can teach people and educate people from the research that we've put together with this. And I don't just think it's us, I think it's the whole smoke industry, is we need to educate. And I don't think it's just the design side. I think it's a contracting side. It's actually commissioning side. It's the maintenance side. We've got to inform the industry of actually what they're putting in, and is it the right components for that particular project. I think as an industry, what we've done in the past is we've kind of said to people, look, we're the experts in this, leave it to us. And what the Building Safety Act is now saying is, I don't want to be leave it to you. I want you to educate me to make sure I'm confident in what you're doing for me. And I think that's a different mindset for the smoke industry. But I also think there's going to be some challenges for the marketplace, because whereas we used to go away and do something and have some assessments, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. You're going to have to stick with what's been done. And I think as a business, it's really important for us is to challenge people when they say, oh, we designed it this way, but do it this way instead. So there's an educational bit for us, but there's also a bit that says, actually, you can't do that anymore. That's not how the Building Safety Act wants you to behave anymore. We've got to design it and install it the way that it was meant to be done.
And last but not least, David, the company is taking part in the fire safety event this year on stand A128 in Hall 5 at the NEC. What's going to be on display at the show and what's your involvement?
We're quite excited by this show in particular. We've actually got a pressurisation cubicle which we're going to have on the stand, which will allow people to actually physically feel and see what a pressurisation system looks like. They'll be able to open the door and see the fans going up and down and what impact that has on the pressure on the door. So it'll actually be a really good opportunity for us to actually show somebody physically what a system would look like. And we're quite excited by that. I'm going to be there for the whole show. We've also got a great opportunity to talk about pressurisation on one of the stages, which we're looking forward to. And it gives us an opportunity to talk about some of the myths and some of the issues that people think there are with this type of system, that we can give them confidence that that's not true. It just needs to be designed well and it needs to be installed in the correct way. We also have some approved installers where we're also going to be doing some training with those people on some of the little nuances of why the SMI system is slightly different to other people's offering in the marketplace.
That brings us to the end of episode 36 of the Fire Safety Matters podcast. Many thanks indeed to our special guests on this edition, namely independent consultant Terry Edge, David Fitzpatrick from Smay Ventilation Systems in the UK, and of course, a regular contributor Warren Spencer, the Managing Director of Blackhurst Bud Solicitors. You can read more on the issues raised in this edition of the podcast and others by visiting the Fire Safety Matters website. The web address you need to access is www.fsmatters.com. We do hope you've enjoyed the content delivered in the podcast and found it informative. Please do contact us if there are any particular themes or issues you would like us to explore on upcoming editions. You can do so on X, formerly Twitter, of course, by using the hashtag FSMPodcast. On that note, do make sure you follow us on X at FSMatters_MAG and also access our LinkedIn page at Fire Safety Matters magazine and website. Please do like and share the content of our regular podcasts and spread the word among your industry colleagues. You can listen to the Fire Safety Matters podcast for free on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube or Podbean. All you need to do is enter the term Fire Safety Matters into your chosen platform search box. We'll see you next time.